It was a disaster unlike any I had ever covered. As a journalist, earthquakes in Australia, hurricanes in the United States, bushfires, of course, floods, but nothing, absolutely nothing prepared me for what I was reporting on, both from the Newsbreakfast studio, but also on the ground a few times as well.
That was journalist and former ABC News Breakfast co-host Michael Rowland. And this is Me, Myself and Disaster. Andrew, what are we discussing today on the show?
Josh, today we're discussing the impact of journalism in disasters. In addition to Michael's reporting roles with the ABC, he also published Black Summer, a series of stories from ABC journalists during the 2019-20 bushfires. We'll be asking Michael about reporting during a disaster, disinformation, staying impartial even during emotionally charged times, and operating in a highly political environment.
Let's chat here on Me, Myself and Disaster.
Michael Rowland, welcome to the show.
Andrew, Josh, thank you very much for the invitation.
During the Black Summer bushfires, the ABC was simultaneously an emergency broadcaster, a media organisation keeping politicians accountable, as well as almost a companion for the collective grief being experienced by millions of Australians. How did you manage the tension between staying impartial and also witnessing a disaster that fire chiefs, they'd warned about this for years prior?
That's a great question. It was a disaster unlike any I had ever covered, and I'd covered quite a few by that stage in my career. As a journalist, earthquakes in Australia, hurricanes in the United States, bushfires, of course, floods, but nothing, absolutely nothing prepared me for what I was reporting on, both from the Newsbreakfast studio, but also on the ground a few times as well over the course of Black Summer. I guess the direct answer to your question is that as a journalist, particularly as an ABC journalist, your job is to be on the ground or reporting from afar, reporting on facts, reporting on information, particularly in bushfires, information that can and does save lives, gathering that information, speaking to the people involved in fighting the fires, the Weather Bureau in terms of weather conditions coming up, and imparting that information to all Australians, but particularly, obviously, those in those bushfire-affected areas. There was a lot of debates going on. We can drill down into this as the conversation goes on about the impact of climate change and was more done in time to prepare communities for what appeared to be an inevitable firestorm over that particular summer. But as a journalist, my main mission on the ground, and I stuck to it all the way through, was get the information, speak to the people involved in the effort, speak to the people affected, and pass on that information as a hopefully trusted, impartial journalist to the Australian community.
I think you touched on a really important point there. Obviously, Andrew and I have worked in the sector for many years now, and there's almost like this duality of role between emergency services and journalism and the news around, you know, as you just mentioned there, there's obviously a really critical partnership around how do we get life-saving messaging and communication out to the community, which, you know, the media and journalism is one of our key methodologies and partnerships that we work in that space. But equally, there's that duality around also holding people to account in terms of what's going on and when things aren't happening. I know that you actually worked with and pushed out a book titled The Black Summer, and it was actually looking at some of those perspectives of some of the journalists that were on the ground working during that time and talking about some of the story arc and some of those initial shocks of some of those unprecedented disasters that we saw during Black Summer around the evacuations and all of those conversations. That's really interesting. In that book, you kind of look towards the future. I know that was a big part of that book, was really kind of going, well, this was our experience, but also let's look towards the future. I guess now that we're 6 years down the track, have we arrived at that future? Have we faced that future? Like, from your perspective, where do you think we are, or have we largely returned to inaction as a community or as a society in this space?
A bit of both. I think there's always going to be a fair bit of complacency once the initial danger period passes when it comes to natural disasters, particularly, sadly, the Black Summer bushfires of 6 years ago. I think the conversation around climate change is much more settled, as it should be. Climate change is a thing. Climate change causes more extreme events more frequently. And broadly speaking, both sides of politics accept that, whereas 6 years ago, we were still having debates with senior figures of the then government, the then coalition government, who were, in the worst case, denying that climate change existed in the first place, let alone starting this awful conflagration that killed so many Australians and wiped out so much countryside. So I think it's positive in the sense that there's more of a broad acceptance that climate change needs to be mitigated. We need to cut our greenhouse gas emissions and join the global community in what is a global effort to tackle climate change and hopefully prevent bushfires of the scale we saw of Black Summer. I'd like to say ever happening again, but happening much less frequently. There's been some positive movement in terms of bushfire resilience and preparedness amongst communities, be it the design of more bushfire-prepared houses, communities being prepared for bushfires, planning decisions taking into effect bushfire zones, and it's not just bushfires, it's floods as well. Simple thing, not building communities on floodplains. I covered the Sydney.
A novel idea.
And I spent some time on the ground in the Sydney floods in 2022, I think, in and around the Windsor northwest area. Large parts of that broad parts of Sydney were built on floodplains, but, you know, designed at a time when, you know, it'll be fine. If there is a 1 in 1,000 year flood, these houses might be affected. Well, sadly, climate change, as we've all seen now, not just through Black Summer, but through all the other events since, has contracted that time frame to 1 in 500 to 1 in, you know, in a much more frequent period of time. So I think the conversation has moved on, but there's also, I guess, that degree of Australian complacency, she'll be right, mate, approach. And we've got through this, and hopefully the insurance companies have paid us out, and we'll cross our fingers for the next one. But I guess that attitude needs to change more broadly too.
It was actually a really good point. And I think as well, it's been really interesting. I know I've obviously been tracking, like many Australians have been tracking as well, how the global conversation can also shape our local conversation here. Because, I mean, it was only the last couple of weeks we're hearing, Queensland talking about, some of the slogans around drill, baby, drill. And, we need to have an oil and petroleum industry in Australia because we need to have fuel security, which, again, like, we don't want to get into that broad conversation, but it's equally interesting that, you know, some of that narrative around there has been some active conversation in the community around, you know, how do we balance out, security, fuel security, our economic security, but equally some of that longer term existential, you know, crisis that's coming for us if we don't, change our habits. Have you kind of been tracking any of that in the media and how does that make you feel, especially given that you've written about these stories, you lived that experience and your thoughts around, how some of those global things like Iran and that can shift our local conversation here in Australia?
Yeah, well, we're seeing that they're shifting our conversation now. We do rely heavily on imported oil, and oil involves lots of bad stuff being pumped into the atmosphere to make oil, and that'll stay the same for the foreseeable future. So we are tied in many respects to the oil and gas industry. But, and they're a huge export earner for Australia, let's not forget that as well. But the transition's happening. The transition will speed up in coming years. And the transition needs to happen, quite frankly, when it comes to tackling climate change, the push to renewables, the push away from fossil fuel industries at an economically responsible pace, of course, given how important oil and gas is to the Australian economy still at the moment. But it's the only way, one of the key ways that we are going to tackle climate change, and getting back to the topic of this conversation, making these natural disasters much less frequent. We're not going to eradicate natural disasters at all, sadly, but the extremity of the Black Summers, of the Sydney floods of those years ago, the Victorian bushfires, which I covered at the start of this year, which wreaked havoc through many communities in rural Victoria. They are only going to become less frequent, hopefully, with a fully throated approach to climate change. And that's happening, but we have to observe economic and resource realities. right at the moment. And I guess the shooting war in Iran's not helping.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of your book, and it was a great read, I encourage anyone to get out there and have a read for themselves. Because again, I think history, the mistake of history is often when it's forgotten. If we forget history, and I think that book is a great collection of stories from the front line in terms of people that lived it from the media and the journalism kind of industry. Is there any stories that kind of really stood out to you or really surprised you or really impacted you as an individual as you were kind of working through that book?
Oh, gee, so many. But my thoughts always go to my ABC colleagues who were not just working, covering bushfires, but living in those communities. I'm thinking of Erin Semler, I think, who wrote the first chapter of the book, ABC Journalist at the Time in Yeppoon in Queensland, getting up and seeing smoke in the distance, not too far from her house, going to her parents' place to make sure they were okay, then realizing her auntie and uncle's house was under threat as well. Juggling these family things and your natural desire to help your family in any circumstance, let alone a bushfire, with doing a fantastic job as a journalist, informing her broader community about what those particular bushfires were doing in Queensland, where they should go, where the evacuation centres were, what was coming up. Erin's just one. There were so many journalists who wrote chapters in that book who were both trying to protect their families and do amazing work. So my along with the emergency services workers, the volunteers, the professional firefighters, I mean, I've always had immense respect for anybody involved in the emergency management space. I'd certainly include my colleagues who were not just covering the story, but living it too.
I remember even back when I was a kid, lying in bed at night time. It was about 2003 or 2004, and there were major bushfires in Sydney at the time. The highway between Wollongong and Sydney was shut, and the whole national park was on fire. And it was listening to the ABC and watching on TV that breaking coverage at that sense. It was pretty scary at the time. But I look back to Black Summer and the recent floods and fires in Victoria. For me, it's at the place where you go is you look at the ABC. And I think there's some say that 24-hour coverage, whether it's on radio or TV, has led to people's lives being saved. Without that, more people would have perished. I'd love to get your perspective on that, whether you agree with that sort of claim and how that... how that sort of approach shaped your way that you dealt the news and reported during these disasters?
I was always very conscious of that. The ABC, as well as being Australia's most trusted independent news source, I always get the plug in, even though I'm not with the ABC anymore. the ABC has for a long time been the official emergency broadcaster, so your stories carry that added weight as the emergency broadcaster. So I was always conscious of my role, first and foremost, as an ABC journalist, but secondly, as somebody who was involved in the emergency broadcasting effort when I was, again, presenting stories, reporting on the bushfires from the New Breakfast studio, but also, most importantly, when I was on the ground in those areas. And I've lost count of the number of people, and not just in and around Black Summer, but also in and around other natural disasters. I've lost count of the number of people who've come up to me and told me directly that, Michael, the ABC saved my life. Thank you. Can you pass on my thanks to your colleagues as well? Or the ABC saved my house. The ABC saved my street. The ABC saved my community by getting timely, accurate information out at the right time in the approach of, in Black Summer's case, really damaging flames. So those conversations certainly make an impact on you as an ABC journalist, and always underscore to me the importance of my role as a journalist and somebody involved intensely in the emergency broadcasting effort.
Yeah, Michael, great point around that kind of responsibility that you guys from the media and journalism kind of carry on your shoulders. But would I be really interested to understand, and I think it's something that's, you think about how the news and how journalism has kind of evolved over the last few years. We're very much in this space of 24-hour news coverage now. We're hyper-connected with social media, and that's obviously changed some of those responsibilities for you in journalism and in media. You know, there's classic examples in the United States now where, you know, we have a United States president that, you know, is texting at all hours of the night, and we have media outlets that are, you know, providing stories on that, commentating on that. How do you think that 24-hour news coverage has reshaped or shaped the landscape around how you report and the responsibility for media agencies in that space?
Great question. It certainly makes it much harder with this slew of misinformation and worse disinformation around, Kira, of the prevalence, increasing the prevalence of social media, and how more and more Australians are using social media as their direct source of news. And we find covering bushfires like Black Summer, there was a lot of misinformation, not people necessarily putting information out there deliberately, but just they've heard of the pub, or they've heard from neighbours over the back fence about the bushfire being in a situation, the threat being in a situation where it's not. And that causes unnecessary panic and stress for people in that particular area. So our job as journalists in that always dynamic, fast-moving environment is to speak directly to the sources of authority, be it the rural fire services, the emergency management authorities directly involved in dealing with the fires, getting that across to Australians, but also trying to reassure people that, or stress to people that if there is wrong information, to tell them that's wrong information. But as social media becomes faster and more complicated to deal with, and just the sheer number of people on it, particularly in a situation like a natural disaster, putting in often for, you know, from a very good place in their heart, information they believe will help, but it's wrong, dealing with all of that certainly adds to the degree of difficulty as a journalist, putting it lightly.
Yes, no, definitely. And I think the emergency management sector as well is also wrestling with that around, you know, what does that landscape look like around how people consume their media, how people consume you know, that national narrative and how they get their information on a day-to-day basis. And I think we all need to have a think about how we kind of keep up with that pace of that hyper-connectivity. Just on that notion, I was mentioning around the United States and their news environment, as many people that would have followed your career would have known that you were in Washington, D.C. as the correspondent there for ABC and, you know, covered things like the election of Barack Obama, which would have been absolutely amazing, and also for some other more grim moments around the global financial crisis. With that kind of international experience that you had and you brought to that lens, how did that also shape your coverage or how you wanted to portray the bushfires, but also that conversation of climate change? Because I know during Barack Obama's campaign, you know, climate change and some of those issues were part of his platform. How did that kind of shape your experience in that space and working as that Washington, D.C. correspondent, shape your how you kind of interacted with the bushfires?
It certainly did help shape my approach to covering bushfires in Australia. I covered my fair share of not so much wildfires, but certainly hurricanes and really big hurricanes. Yeah. I arrived in the States just as Hurricane Katrina was whipping its destructive way through New Orleans, and was covering that and several other hurricanes, because they're pretty common over there all the way through. But you're right, at the time Barack Obama was committed to having the United States lead the global fight on climate change and to reduce greenhouse emissions and have a global effort at doing so. Of course, that commitment in the States has wavered over the years, and now we have a US president who has walked out of the Paris Agreement. His administration is full of climate change deniers and makes it harder for the US to lead as the preeminent global citizen, which it needs to do in the fight against climate change. So, and the debate on climate change is way more polarized over there than it is here. So that filtered into my experience and helped me cover not just the fires and natural disasters, cyclones on the ground here in Australia, but gave me an appreciation of, I guess, how polarized, unnecessarily, in my personal view, but how polarized the climate change debate, and there should be no debate, but sadly is in the United States. And I brought that knowledge and that experience back to Australia when I was conducting interviews on climate change, often in the midst of disasters like Black Summer.
Hey everyone, just a quick one. If you're enjoying this chat, make sure you hit that like or subscribe button on whatever app you're using. That way, you'll never miss an episode. Let's get back to the show.
It's interesting, like we talk about the media, and for me, seeing the ABC is often just attacked and accused of bias, and then there's calls to from some of the right-wing media and commentators to defund the ABC. But in the big disasters is where the ABC is really unmatched by any of the commercial broadcasters, and people follow the ABC, as we discussed earlier. It kind of feels almost cruel that at that time when we're seeing this really good coverage that is a time that the ABC can get that political traction to get more funding and get that sort of recognition, but it also can't. Like, what are your thoughts on the future of that and how we deal with that?
Oh, we just deal with it as ABC journalists. I'm still speaking to present tense, but my colleagues at the ABC, I know, will continue to deal with it by doing what they do. That is being impartial journalists, reporting on the facts as they see it, in this case, as it applies to natural disasters, reporting on the facts as we know them on climate change and the fact that climate change does make extreme weather events like bushfires much more frequently. Yes, I was getting pushback, as were a lot of my colleagues in the midst of Black Summer, asking our leaders, asking senior ministers about, well, you know, do you agree? You know, let's get to tin tacks. Do you agree that climate change is making these events like the Black Summer bushfires more frequent? And in many cases, they'd shy away from saying that, whether they were worried about, you know, what elements of their political base would say about that, whether they wanted to, and justifiably in some cases, that the line would be, well, Michael, now is not the time to talk about that. Now is the time to focus on the prior effort. But when is the right time, right, to talk about climate change? And why shouldn't you ask and bring to the public's attention and put our leaders under pressure to do more on climate change than in the midst of disasters like Black Summer? So there'll always be that tension between journalists doing their jobs and asking the tough questions, politicians pushing back, the ABC being criticised for its journalists asking those sort of questions. But I think we are independent, and independent means we are not pressured by any particular party, any particular government or opposition, and we just keep doing what we do. But it certainly makes, again, that job of being a journalist in the midst of a natural disaster that much more challenging.
It almost just brings that sense of frustration when you spoke then around, now is not the time. It's like the sense of, oh, there's been a mass shooting, we need thoughts and prayers. Like, it's that sort of sense of just, we can't just go on with this sense of, well, when is the right time to talk about this? But it's frustrating, and it just reminds me of, yeah, many disasters we've had, and Black Summer in particular.
Yeah, no, it is very frustrating. And yes, I sadly covered my fair share of school shootings and other shootings in the States, and getting the thoughts and prayers line ad nauseum at the same time as the US politicians did absolutely nothing to tackle gun laws and make gun control a bigger issue in the state. So, yeah, it's just I often found myself second-guessing, asking questions in Black Summer about climate change because of the sheer enormity of what was going on. You know, that was the key focus. You know, where are the danger spots? Who's in danger? How can we tell these people? What's the death toll? How many hectares have been burnt? Where's that fire front expected to go overnight when the wind changes? They are by far the most important bits of information, but we didn't get to this point if it weren't for climate change making these fires as ferocious as they were. So I did find myself second-guessing myself sometimes, but I just felt obligated to keep asking those questions about climate change, as I did, covering the floods in Sydney and elsewhere and other bushfires since.
Well, thank you for doing that. And I think that's really important. And looking at the coverage of some of these disasters, there's that, I think the media plays that pivotal role in highlighting some of these key issues and also highlighting particular communities affected by the disaster. And that media, I think we can't underestimate the impact of the media in terms of things like funding or applying political pressure and that external support to some of those communities. But there's also, I've seen, and this has been something in not just Black Summer, but many of the fires and floods we've had recently, where some of those communities get a lot of the coverage and other communities get very little. And some of those communities, like Indigenous communities, are the ones that often miss out. Having said that, the ABC does probably the best job in terms of being out there with its regional footprint and being able to get to most places. Do you think coverage across all media outlets adequately represents that full range of people affected by Black Sun, but also disasters since then? And another question I wanted to ask you, are there still sort of Black Summer stories out there that are yet to be told?
Yeah, there certainly are. And the biggest Black Summer stories that have been told in the 6 or so years since is the reconstruction efforts, communities getting their beloved communities back together, often a very slow process, and also the ongoing mental trauma suffered by people in the caught up in the fires, the emergency service workers. Their story's still happening, but they're untold stories in the sense the news cycle being what it is, moves on to the next big thing. But we must never forget that those communities affected in Black Summer will never recover, certainly mentally. They can recover physically, often at a slow pace, but the mental scars will be there forever. Yes, in terms of the breadth of coverage, the ABC has hundreds or thousands of journalists, and certainly every effort was thrown at that big story in the summer of 2019, 2020. But there was only so much we could do as journalists. We, unlike most other media organisations, do have fantastic regional offices right around the country, really committed journalists doing great jobs. But that story, those fires were so huge that we couldn't cover everything and every community affected. You raise an interesting point about Indigenous communities. There are a lot of Indigenous Australians with fire management techniques going back tens of thousands of years, arguing that they should have been observed. The Indigenous Australians know country, that they know how the land works. And there were a lot of Indigenous Australians caught up in the fires who were angry that their cultural knowledge, their cultural stories weren't used to fight the fires, to be part of that effort. But broadly speaking, yeah, we did what we could do with limited resources given the scale of the fires. There were always areas that we couldn't get to for safety reasons, and always areas we couldn't get to just because it was such an expansive and exhausting process, being on the ground 24/7 for days, weeks, and as Black Summer turned out to be, months.
I just want to go back one step and just ask you a question. But I guess in the same vein, we were just talking before around, that pressure and how do we, some of the experiences you had trying to approach some of those national conversations that are hard, and we do need to have them, but when's the right time to have those conversations? I think will always be a polarizing issue in community. And I guess we also have to come and be pragmatic about the fact that politics will always be politics, and we have to figure out how we work within and operate within that environment with the best practice. But I guess if you had the opportunity from your perspective, given that you've reported on countless contentious issues and you had the opportunity to rewrite the playbook around as a nation, when is the right time and how we would actually approach these conversations, what would that look like if you had that chance to redefine those conversations or how we do it?
I just make it a much more common part of our political discourse. Climate change drops off the table when we aren't in the midst of events like the Black Summer bushfires. Again, going back to the news cycle, big stories happen. We're in the midst of the US-Iran war at the moment, cost of living pressures for Australians, interest rates going up. They are, in many cases, understandably more front and center issues in the minds of many Australians. But the planet is heating. The Weather Bureau, NASA, our top scientists, tell us that Australia is doing a lot on the climate change front, but we need to do a whole lot more in terms of bringing those emissions down and tackling climate change. So I would try to have climate change much more vigorously inserted into the daily, weekly, monthly, yearly political debate, but it is hard. I speak as a journalist, knowing how the news cycles work. Achieving that, and it's quite, I guess, sad and tragic that the only time climate change debates and conversations really spike is when houses start burning down and when houses start flooding, and we need to do a whole lot more than that.
Yeah, no, great point and well put. Just back onto your book, and something that, again, as Andrew and I have already said, we really encourage people to go and hear those stories of all of the that happened from journalists, and as you were saying, that these stories are written from a very personal space. It was mentioned earlier in the interview that, you know, the first chapter around the journalist from Yeppoon, and it was really from their firsthand experience and their perspective around their feelings of grief or their feelings of exhaustion or what they felt or what they were going through at the time. Do you think disaster journalism in the future needs to be more human? Because I think we almost get in a space in a disaster where, and I know from our perspective and our background in emergency services, you know, you take on an authoritative tone and it's do this and do that. But I get the sense that, and again, you mentioned at the start around, but these are humans, these are personal stories. These are regional journalists in their own community with their own families. What does it look like to be an honest witness in those spaces? And do we actually need to change the future of disaster journalism in Australia and make it more empathetic and more human-centred?
Yes, we do. And listen, most journalists approach their job in disaster zones with a very empathetic framework. But, yeah. I mean, I've seen over the years journalists, sadly, who don't and give us all a very bad name. You know, literally thrusting microphones into people grieving the loss of a loved one or a house, getting their desired tearful reaction for the clicks and the headlines. That is not the way to do it. I always had the approach when I was covering bushfires, and I certainly used this in Black Summer. If you know, I spent a lot of time at evacuation centres, and if I saw people, not necessarily in distress, but just sitting outside having a cup of tea, just having a moment, I'd go up to them and introduce without a camera, without a microphone, just Michael Nolan, no notebook initially. Just go up there and say, hi, I'm Michael Rowland, I'm a journalist for the ABC. You know, some people knew me, given my role as the presenter of News Breakfast, some didn't. And I just speak to them and, you know, ask human questions. How are you? What's happened? Have you heard, when was the last time you heard from missing loved one? How long have you had the house that's either been burnt down or under threat? And 9 times out of 10, you'd have a conversation with them. Sometimes, understandably, they didn't want to speak. I'd turn around on my heels and walk away and leave them alone. And then if I, at the right time, I'd ask, well, that's such a compelling story. Would you mind if I brought my colleague over there with the camera and we interviewed you for the ABC? Again, 9 times out of 10, they'd say yes. And yeah. I'd conduct what I hoped were always very empathetic and personal interviews. So, I mean, that was my approach, and I think that's the approach by and large most journalists bring to the table when it comes to disaster reporting. Some don't, and that's you know, a shame. But, they're going back to your question, there does need to be always a more personal and empathetic approach to disaster reporting.
You know, we're having this conversation here around, you know, an event that happened 6 years ago, stories that were recorded, what we hope for the future. How are we? I'd love to understand from your perspective, how are we managing that succession planning, especially in the journalism? Like, we've got, like, I mean, I was in a job where it was my job to, I worked for in government, was to basically watch the news 24/7 to know what was going on and be able to be across it. And I've just noticed as well that there is younger and younger journalists coming through the ranks, and it's, like, what does that succession plan look like? How do, like, all these stories and these lessons that you're talking about, what does that look like, Michael? How do we instill that in them so that they're ready for the future and we're actually on the right path as we move forward in this space?
Well, the ABC, like most media organisations, have ongoing training for journalists. It depends on which jurisdiction you're in, but in Victoria, it was every 2 years, maybe 3 years, as a journalist to get anywhere near a bushfire zone, you have to do a course. Initially, a face-to-face course, then an online course to get your media accreditation. So you learn about bushfires and ways to approach them through those mechanisms. Also, mentoring is a huge thing. I know personally in the ABC and younger journalists, I hope, have learned from me, as I did when I was a younger journalist. Learning from older journalists. I think my first disaster was, and this dates me horribly, but it was the Newcastle earthquake of 1989. I was a fresh young cadet journalist. I was up there in Newcastle, New South Wales, covering that disaster, also with senior journalists. I watched what they do. I watched how they spoke to victims' families. I watched how they got information from emergency authorities. I learned from that, and I use those skills going forward. Equally, in Black Summer, there are a lot of younger journalists I was working with doing reports, and I was presenting live for News Breakfast on location from some of the areas affected, and they were helping me, and hopefully they learned from me. So that is the way the next generation, the generation after that, a journalist will learn, hopefully, to keep doing the job expected of them as ABC journalists, generally speaking, but in particular when events like Black Summer bushfires happen.
I did when you made your retirement announcement, I did actually see your LinkedIn post, and I think they even popped up the photo on News Breakfast of a very young Michael Rowland, and it did... I hadn't realised how long you'd actually been in the industry for, but the picture was telling, and now you've let the cat out of the bag here today. But on that note, you've had an esteemed career. You've spent a long time in the industry, and we've been talking about some of those changes today and what we've seen and what the future needs to look like and potentially where we're heading with this. And I think we're almost on this exponential curve again. You know, we haven't even started to talk about artificial intelligence and what does that mean for the media industry and what does that mean for how we report on things and how people access information and even looking at, you know, the collapse of many local newspapers that we're seeing in our society, in our regional communities. But for someone in the immediate impact area of flood or fire, do you think from where you've come from to where we are now, do you think the overall access to information is better or worse than what we've seen at the past? And what about for journalists? Is their job easier? Is it harder? What's your thoughts in that space?
Oh, the job's easier in many respects because there is much more information, credible information available. There's a lot of disinformation, misinformation, dare I say fake news around, but there is the proliferation, the growth of the internet as a news source means that there are a greater amount of facts available instantly at your fingertips. So that does make the job of a journalist easier. Nothing beats, of course, getting directly into contact with, in a bushfires case, or the authorities, going to the areas affected, speaking to the people face to face. So it does make it easier. I mean, an AI robot isn't going to do as good a job as a journalist going up to a bushfire victim, or we hope. Who knows where the future will take us on that. I don't even contemplate where that will be. So it is, you know, it's a double-edged sword. We all know the disadvantages of social media and the misinformation, disinformation. But I think on balance, it's a good thing that there is much more information available out there, and a lot of it is credible and factual, to be transmitted quickly, more quickly, and speed is of the essence, as you guys know, in natural disasters, to be transmitted much more quickly as a result to those who need that information.
I really, I know we're running out of time here, so I just want to shove one more quick question in, but I think it's, I find it really interesting, and this is probably a good thing, that we've got more and more people taking an active role in disasters. So in communities are being empowered and people are standing up and helping, and that's great. And I've done a lot of research into how communities mobilize, but also there's a lot of communities helping to spread information. And I was over in the US for the big hurricane a couple of years ago, and I saw so much of the information coming out through influencers. It wasn't the authorities, but it was YouTubers, it was people on Instagram communicating that, oh, go fill up your gas tank because you might be running out of fuel, or go to Walmart and stock up on groceries because the hurricane's coming. So we're operating this almost polluted information environment. And I want to ask you, Michael, how has this changed how you work within the mainstream media, operating within this polluted environment of community and government and media? There's so much being communicated, but it's messy.
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I had a very simple answer to that. I don't, only to say that, again, journalists at the ABC and journalists at most of the established news outlets in Australia will just need to keep doing their job, and that is reporting on facts, FACTS, still a very important word, in this internet age, and getting those facts out to the public. And it's all about engaging increasingly younger audiences on social media, TikTok in particular, in bite-sized chunks. You can get a factual story, information across in a 30-second, you know, bite-sized chunk on TikTok, and there are some great journalists at the ABC doing just that, to deal with all the memes and all the nonsense you get on a platform like that. So we've just got to keep doing what we do as journalists, as independent journalists, as fact-based journalists, hard as though it is, and as seemingly insurmountable as the challenge is of dealing with that misinformation and disinformation, as the years go on, we just got to keep doing it, because if there aren't any independent journalists around at a time of national emergency like the Black Summer bushfires, then you'd hate to think what the impact would have been on those communities and areas affected if those factual bits of information weren't transmitted at the right time.
Yeah. We unfortunately have run out of time, and thank you so much for this conversation. It has been awesome. Andrew and I have been actually fanboying a little bit about this, because we have obviously followed your career, and again, our paths have crossed in the media, and we've watched you from afar, and we thank you for taking the time to coming have a conversation. But one last question that I really want to touch on, because I know it's really important to Andrew and I, to the industry, and I know for yourself, as Andrew and myself, you know, we've attended road crashes, we've seen flooded homes and disasters, and you know, the mental health impacts that come with that. And I know, you know, a fellow journalist at the ABC had an open conversation with me around this, Hamish McDonald, around the impacts of disasters and being in those spaces and reporting on those issues and the mental health side of that. Do you see the impact of witnessing trauma in your colleagues? Like, have you witnessed that? And how is, you know, there's been a lot of work in the emergency management industry around how we manage mental health and how we deal with that. But are you seeing that same kind of emphasis or work in journalism, in the media, for those that find themselves in these traumatic positions?
Yes, and it's a very good thing. When I started 10,000 years ago as a journalist, not that long. Only 5,000 years ago. Dealing with the stresses from, we as journalists, we cover also often very bad road crashes and murder scenes and natural disasters. The processing mechanism was going to the pub and drinking way too many beers. Fast forward, 20, 30, 40 years, and there is some fantastic trauma counselling services available to the ABC internally. We have external help as well. I know that applies to most other media organisations as well. And journalists do take it up. I've taken it up in the past after some pretty harrowing experiences on the ground, both here and in the United States. And it's, as you both know, it is enormously helpful. And that is one good thing the industry has done when it comes to putting their journalists in harm's way, both physical and mental harm, dealing with these big stories, in that they have offered these ways of dealing with that grief and that trauma going forward. So, hopefully that continues, because I know there's a lot of resources and a lot of thought, speaking about the ABC in particular, put into how do we keep improving these services, how can we offer them more freely to journalists. And I think that is good for the industry and, more importantly, good for the people involved.
Absolutely. And thank you for being so open and honest about that. It's certainly a challenging area, but something that's an important focus. And we need to keep doing more of that, both for emergency services, journalists, and all those community members who have to face this year in, year out as climate change takes hold. And we're seeing more and more disasters, which is unfortunately the sad case of it all. Anyway, thank you, Michael, for joining us today. And it's been a very intriguing and interesting discussion. And I think our listeners certainly will have plenty to take away from this episode. All 10,000 years of your career has been very interesting to listen to. So we've shared links in the show notes to your book, Black Summer, and a bit more on your role in reporting during the fires on our website at memyselfdisaster.com and across our social channels. Michael Rowland, thanks so much for joining us on Me, Myself and Disaster.
It was my pleasure, and straight back at you guys. Back at you guys. Thanks for the really informative questions. Questions based on your lived experience as well. It's been a really great and fascinating conversation.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for on the show today. Join us again next time on Australia's Leading Disaster Podcast as we talk to more interesting guests from across the world about their experiences during disasters. We'll catch you then. Me, Myself and Disaster is a production of Beyond Disaster. Find out more at beyonddisaster.au.